Hey there. Welcome to the Women in Our Town podcast, a place for unsilent women to have important conversations. I'm your host, Purva Miller. Let's go. Welcome back. My guest today is Jasmine Sharma, a South Asian actor, writer, and activist who recently graduated from Northwestern University. Jasmine is passionate about building community to interrupt social norms and make the spaces she's in not only equitable, but warm and funny like air-fried chickpeas. Her plays tackle issues of race, gender, and inequity, and her essay, Be Scared Not Racist, was commissioned by the Ai Wei community, founded by actor and activist Jamila Jamil. Welcome, Jasmine. I am so excited to welcome you to the Women in Our Town podcast. Your work is so interesting. You're a playwright and an actor, and you're also a student who's graduating this year. Congratulations. I'm very curious to know what the last, you know, year has been like going to school virtually. Well, welcome to the Women in Our Town podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
That's awesome. And, you know, I've read a lot of your work. I've read your plays, and there's so many interesting things to talk about. But I'd first like to, you know, get a sense a little bit about who you are. You know, give us a little bit of, background about you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I grew up in New Jersey. I'm a third gen South Asian. I grew up in very, you know, predominantly white spaces. And then my high school experience was very specialized in that half of my day was like the classes you take in mm-hmm. high school. And then the other half of my day was like theater specific classes. I like entered theater as a, like, you know, through dance and musical theater. And then found playwriting at that high school. And then I was really trying to decide between BFAs or BA programs, but I didn't mm-hmm. want to like give up studying playwriting. If I wanted to pursue acting as my main focus, I wanted to like hold both of those hats in the same, at the same time. And so then that brought me to Northwestern because the program is a BA. So you can take all of your classes in a very like, there's like a menu, choose your own adventure,
right.
like vibe to it. Yeah. And then here I've had some really crazy experiences. But I've also like really found a lot of wonderful, specifically femmes of color who've become my cohort of sorts and make me really excited for what the hell this theater industry is going to look like when we get out of this computer screen.
Absolutely. And, you know, your plays and your work, I've read your play Radial Gradient. I've read your play Gut Punch, both amazing, amazing plays. And your work tackles issues of race and the BIPOC student experience and typically tends to play out, at least in my mind, because obviously there's all this imagination that you know, you have to put in if you're not watching a play.
Yeah.
And it plays out on a liberal arts campus. So tell me, what informs a lot of your writing and why do you write about these topics? Why do you choose to tackle them in your plays?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was actually looking back through my my past writing as well before Radial Gradient, before Gut Punch, because I think it really, I figured out the kind of work I want to write pretty recently. Like, I think Radial Gradient is one of the first plays where I figure out what the stories I want to tell and who I want to tell them with. But all of my work really comes from a place of, I mean, I don't want to be like trauma, but it's a little bit, it comes from trauma and, right. And like questions that I'm still working through. Mm-hmm. Lily Padilla is an amazing playwright. They wrote How to Defend Yourself. And something that they had said in one of their talkbacks, when they came to visit our school was that, they wrote How to Defend Yourself to like heal their own trauma in the hopes that it would resonate with someone else in the audience. And I think that was a big, motivator in writing Radial Gradient. And then also with Gut Punch, a very similar thing. But I think the liberal college campus is something that really came out of, seeing a lot of work at my, college that was very white centric, that was very, mm-hmm. like, even if they are, even if there were POC in those shows, very much not like the ingenue, very much not the mm-hmm. lead, mm-hmm. unless it was like that one ethnic play of the season. And that's something that really frustrated me, especially because also being an actor, I mean, there are roles that I want that I just have not seen before. And because yeah. a lot of these like very prestigious universities are very white, the plays that they teach are also very white. And so I didn't know about, you know, like, I didn't know about South Asian writers. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult finding material, especially like material for South Asian femme my age is very difficult. I was seeing a lot of like child brides and terrorist wives. And right. that's not, that wasn't it. That wasn't it. Yeah. And so, I wanted funny work. I wanted funny stuff. And so, but funny with a point. I wanted, there were a lot of things going into it, but I think that's why a lot of my, work right now is, I have a play that I'm working on with, under construction at the Road Theater right now that is tentatively like titled Canceled. It is also dealing with like college aged, liberal arts, individuals, in like the social media setting, but like it's right. I'm a big proponent of write what you know. Like that's the only way I feel like I'm writing something I'm quote unquote allowed to write. Like I feel like there are some stories that aren't for me to tell, but the ones that are things that I have like some kind of connection to, and I'm excited about maybe that changing in the future. I'm right. excited about, I would love to be a writer who could like do the research of something they're completely distant from and then find a way to like connect and write that story. But I think for right now, it's really important to me, especially with like these questions that we're having in the theater industry now of authenticity and representation of like writing things that are immediate to me.
Right. And, you know, that's, you bring up a good point. I recently interviewed a woman in publishing, and she's like a big powerhouse in the Canadian publishing world. And she talked about own voices, writers, own voice writers, what's called in the industry, own voice writers. And she said that, you know, historically, and by historically, I mean like up until like maybe last year or the industry starting to have these conversations, the writers of color typically have written about trauma or racism, or, you know, if it's a South Asian or East Asian writer, they're typically writing about like the immigrant experience. Yes. And her take was that, you know, which I agree with, is that writers, she wants the industry to start paying attention to writers of color outside of these like trauma driven narratives, that we can write funny things, we can write joyful things, we can write those stories, we can weave in our own, you know, our own experiences. And a lot of those experiences, of course, do involve trauma for writers of color and creators of color because of the world we live in. But we don't have to center our stories around child brides or terrorism or the immigrant experience alone. We can write about other things. And so I think, you know, the idea of like weaving in what you know to tell different kinds of stories is really powerful. And talking about the liberal arts college campus, that's something, you know, I want to talk a little bit about that, because, you know, I'm a person of color and South Asian woman in North America and Canada, went to college here. And, you know, I always thought of college as this place where you can really find yourself. It's really the first time as a young person, you're out on your own, you're exploring. And that's how college is really packaged to young people, is that this is a place that you can come and be authentic and be whoever you want to be. Mm-hmm. You know, my experience is probably not similar to your experience or 10 years apart in our college experiences. So, you know, I'd love to get your thoughts as a theater major at a liberal arts college. What's that experience been like? And you know, theater especially tends to be a sort of whitewashed space, if you will, on college campuses. So, you know, I'd just love to get your thoughts on that a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so much of my college experience is defined like by the theater community here, especially because Northwestern does have a very large theater program. I mean, there's like 100 theater majors per every year, and that doesn't even include all the student theater that's going on with students of other majors as well, like participating. The community is very tight-knit. The department is very tight-knit. There are very, very few teachers of color. And I've never had an acting teacher of color that really was, I think, detrimental. It was, that was something that really hurt me, I think, as a student. I've never had a playwriting teacher of color, something that was tough. And I think when I first came to Northwestern, I think I was trying so hard to do so many different things, trying to find somewhere where I would like fit and also be able to like shine and also learn. And so, I mean, I auditioned for the musical theater program. I got in, but I was still like writing plays and I was submitting them to student boards and they were going up. And I mean, I was in a couple of comedy groups, but they were all white. I mean, everywhere I was going, it was still very white centric. And it was a lot of the same people in the same spaces, just in different contexts. And then, I mean, still auditioning for shows as an actor. I mean, it was very tough. It was very tough not only to cast work the way I want to cast work, but it's very hard to, at least at Northwestern, name something when it's happening. It's very hard to disrupt moments of racism and misogyny. And it's just, it's very tough, especially because it's such a close-knit community. And I mean, you don't want to be the actor that's difficult to work with. You don't want to be the student who's difficult to work with, because then they're not going to put up your play, or they're not going to put you in their show.
Right.
Or they're not going to put you in showcase. I mean, as a senior right now, that was also it's something I'm noticing. I'm looking at these like lists and I'm like, ooh, woo, that it's white. It's white in here. I didn't sign up to be the only brown girl in a lot of these rooms. But in being the only brown girl in a lot of these rooms, I did feel a sense of responsibility to leave this school better than I found it, especially as I got my favorites. I got my favorites in the younger classes. I don't want them to not have a teacher of color at all, ever. And so this summer was a lot of organizing with other students and making demands of the theater department, and publishing a lot of instances of racism that's happened among the students. I think sharing stories of what your experience in classrooms have been, what happens when a microaggression is thrown your way by another student. There's absolutely no equity training that the teachers go through to be able to intervene and be able to facilitate that classroom experience. I mean, I ended up leaving my acting sequence at the end of winter quarter, and then, I mean, spring went online, but I mean, I was I was being referred to as a sensitive slum dog. So here we
oh my goodness.
There's a lot, and like that was said in jest, and it was said probably drunk. And I mean, alcohol is a whole other conversation to have. But there was a lot of stuff happening, and I think publishing these instances. And I don't want to share anybody's experience that isn't mine, but like we have a POC group chat. And the number of people who were asking to be added to it, and it was just like a nice. Not nice, but like a cathartic thing to be able to share these experiences, name them as our white classmates were like discovering racism for the first time this summer. So there's also the thing of, and this is what I'm working on in my new play, of like watching your white classmates who have so actively and deeply hurt you, gaslight you, tell you that didn't happen. And then just decide they're a social justice warrior overnight on Instagram is like there's a cognitive dissonance there that's just very messy. That's something I'm working through right now. Like, oh well, when do we say they've changed when there's still so much harm that hasn't been acknowledged or apologized for or made steps to improve? So that's my liberal because also with the liberal college campus experience, I mean, there is this like sense of moral superiority of, oh, we're not a school in the South. Like we're liberal here. We're not Republicans.
Yes, definitely. And then that comes up in your plays as well, which we will get into to a certain extent. But I think that, you know, it's really interesting to your point about social media. That is something that is a little bit of a, like, I don't want to say a pet peeve, but it's definitely something that has bothered me over the last, you know, few months, the summer of 2020 and since, especially because, you know, I had, and this is not, again, like not to call people out. I know people are trying to learn and trying to understand and do their best, but I've had friends say to me, you know, I'm watching TV from the 90s. I'm watching Sex and the City again, or I'm watching Friends. And you realize that, oh, there's not a lot of diversity. And part of me is like, you just realized that, like, you know, is that yeah. This is something that was obvious to me 15 years ago, 20 years ago, but at that time it was just normal. So I just accepted it along with everybody else. And also that the work that needs to be done is, it feels like posting on Instagram is the way, the performative wokeness is the way for people to signal that they are in your corner without really having to do any of the real work. So yeah. I can imagine that is, you know, that's definitely something dealt with.
And what's tough about the virtue signaling right now is that, I mean, social media is like the only way we can connect right now while we're still in COVID land it's the safest way, but it's tough to equate sharing a story and an infographic to compare that to not disrupting silence when like these moments were happening not only a year ago. And I mean I'm really interested to see what happens when we get back into classrooms and theater spaces and like workplaces, if this becomes a blip, if this signaling moment of like sustained, we're listening, we're learning, et cetera, just doesn't have a real life impact. Because I think so often, I think like people of color, but also specifically women of color, are told by their parents, by trusted friends, like older sister figures, be prepared for this, be on the lookout for this. Yeah. This is what a microaggression will feel like. I can't name it for you, but like, just be on the lookout. Like, if you feel uncomfortable, don't worry, you're not alone in that. But like, I think the conversation has now been raised to, don't worry that you're not uncomfortable. Don't worry that you're not the only one uncomfortable in the room. It's now like, it's on everybody else to then name that discomfort, so that the onus isn't on the person who is being marginalized in that space.
No, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And it's such an interesting place that we're in right now, because it's so recent. Like, I've recently come out of the corporate world, and that's where I was for the last 6 or 7 years, ever since I left college. And what you're saying about naming the thing, we haven't had the language to be able to understand or process what we're feeling. Like, I remember being in a meeting full of people, a diversity and inclusion meeting, where the conversation felt so much like box checking, like, oh, we need to have, you know, X number of women and X number of people. And I was like, well, that's not real true diversity. Diversity is being like, not box checking and trying to fill quotas. It's about actually being open to diversity on all fronts, whether it's race, whether it's gender, whether it's thought, diversity of opinions, diversity of experience. And so that's a really interesting point, because I remember, as an example, someone said in a board meeting, who was considerably senior to me, that they don't see color and they don't see race, and which at the time everybody was like, oh wow, that sounds really progressive. This was like 3 years ago. And now we know that, well, you can't take someone's race or color out of their lived experience, because for people of color, race and, you know, being a person of color informs every day of your life. It informs so many decisions. It informs the way you move through the world. And so, to your point, I think that naming it and being able to recognize it and then actively disrupting it, like speaking up, not just saying, oh, well, I'm not racist because I don't outwardly participate in racism, but actively being anti-racist when you see microaggressions, when you see acts of racism being, you know, done to your classmates and to your friends and colleagues.
Yeah. It's so interesting what you said about, you can't remove race from the person, because we're having a lot of these, conversations in acting classes right now, or, I mean, those of us who are taking the extra labor of explaining it, like just from an actor standpoint, when you're bringing in material and you're doing it in front of your class, like the actor, all the actor of color always knows that they're an actor of color. Like they know they are a racialized body. And so when we're doing like Chekhov and stuff like that, like we are still an actor of color doing Chekhov. Like there is no, you're not playing white. And I think a big part of the acting curriculum in a lot of these schools is that they are all designed for white bodies, white actors, but that's not useful. Like for me, what would be useful as an actor of color is doing new work, because I mean, when I go into a contemporary plays audition, I'm not going in with a Chekhov monologue. Like I know how to perform that, like very white Masha, but I'm not, I'm not going to play her. And so it's a very, it's a tough thing of like trying to, but also that's been the curriculum for so long. So trying to like push, just like push in.
No, I absolutely agree. And, you know, so that kind of is a good segue into your play Radial Gradient, which is amazing. Absolutely loved it. And it brought up so many questions of things that I hadn't thought about or considered. But where I'd like to start in discussing it is the problem of our complicity in our own oppression and erasure. And you know, that's a huge topic. So we could the whole podcast could be that. But you tackle it in a very subtle and nuanced way. I don't want to give away the play without, you know, I don't want to give away too much, but I think that this play happens against the backdrop of Greek life, of Rush Week that happened in the past. And then there's a psychology department where this quote unquote experiment is underway. And, you know, Greek life is rife with problems. And I never even considered, because there's so many other problematic elements to Greek life. I hadn't even considered the, you know, stuff about racism. But when I started thinking about Greek life and the sort of the opportunities it provides, we're told as young people that, you know, you just have to go be part of something that is going to give you the opportunities to succeed in this world. And that inherently ends up making us complicit, because the opportunities that help people succeed in this world were built for white people. So, you know, I'd love to get your thoughts on why you chose to tackle a play that talked about people of color participating in their own oppression and erasure.
Absolutely. I mean, this goes back to like why, to the beginning question of like why I started writing the play of that. I mean, when I came in as a freshman, I didn't really know very many people at Northwestern, and suddenly all the groups I was in that were theater spaces and comedy spaces, I was noticing that, like, you know, I mean, there's a lot of overlap between Greek life and theater at Northwestern. And I mean, the girls I wanted to be friends with and the girls I was in groups with were all rushing. So why don't I rush? And so then I did. And I mean, I was very good at it. I'm very good at performing. I'm very good at performing what they want to see. I'm very good at performing whiteness. I've been assimilating for a minute. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I've worked through this year with like how I identify. And I mean, I have a line in Radial Gradient that is, I feel more like a color than a culture, because I have always said I'm American. I've like not been to India yet in my life. It's very much a thing of, I don't speak Hindi. I eat burgers. I am the way I align myself, was like appealing, to the sororities I was rushing. It was like, oh, you can be our diverse token, but you're very much like us. And that was a tough thing of, and also like, I didn't go to a lot of the, initiation meetings, chapter meetings, because I was in rehearsal. So I really didn't know what I was getting myself into until my sophomore year, when I was living in the sorority house. And I knew a few months in, I would be deactivating. But the consequences of deactivating were tough. I mean, living in the house was tough. Like, it was just like daily microaggressions in the kitchen, in the bathroom. And like, it's very... and there was this culture of like, we're all alternative girls. We're not like other sororities.
Right.
So trying to name anything was very much like, but I'm a woke feminist, white feminist, but still feminist.
Right.
And so there was a lot of dissonance going on that I wasn't really able to like name, but I knew I didn't want to be a part of it. I left. And then it was in my junior year when I was thinking about all of these friendships that have now crumbled. I was like, why did they crumble? I thought we were friends and the sorority was like a, just like it's where we live. But then that like brought up questions of race and class and access to opportunity. And so that's where I started writing Radial Gradient. It's because I couldn't figure out why I joined and why I quit. I was exploring my own complicity in this system. But then I realized like complicity within Greek life, which has been specifically created for white people to keep non-white people out. It's like only used for networking and elitism.
Yep.
At the end of the day, like, yes, the parties are fun. Awesome. They are also very problematic.
Yes.
And so there's we talk a lot about what frats do wrong, but sororities also are causing equal harm. But then that like also raises the question of like, what about Northwestern itself as a university? It was not letting brown girls in always. And that raises like the question of also like, what is our like American government structure? So there's, it kept getting bigger. But when things get big, I know I personally can't comprehend them or I need to like read all the books on them first. And so with Radial Gradient, I really wanted to explore what are three girls who used to be friends who are all women of color. Cause I also wanted, this was supposed to go up at Northwestern in the fall. But COVID hit. But I was also very conscious of the fact that the audience would probably be mostly white. And so why put a white character on stage when the audience can represent that whiteness?
Right.
Radial Gradient is a play of three women of color discussing racism and like exploring complicity for themselves, but they don't need to have a white character on stage with them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think that, you know, when you talked about like sort of the microaggressions that you couldn't name and that you experienced, it's one of those things where, because it is so pervasive, at a certain point, you start feeling like there's something wrong with you. I've been there where I have felt like I'm too sensitive because, you know, if someone's committing microaggressions to me, whether in the workplace or in college, I'm too sensitive. This is my problem. And so then you take it upon yourself as the person of color to not only now have to deal with those microaggressions, but then there's all this blame and you just think that you're not assimilating and you're not, you know, cut out for this. And there's a lot of kind of self-directed blame. When you talked about the times that, you know, how you've spent your whole life assimilating, that to me, I had this like picture in my mind because I've seen it so many times. There's, and I'm going to speak specifically about people of color, South Asian heritage, because that is the space that I understand. I'm not going to speak for other groups, but I have seen, and I mean, somewhat I've seen this in other groups, but yeah, specifically in South Asian of people of color, which is what we are. there's the girls that fit in and they are typically, you know, they typically dress like everybody else. They don't have an accent. Most of the time, you know, either grown up somewhere in the area or at least on the continent of North America. They're very plugged in with what is hip and cool and popular on social media. And you see the other side of this where, and in my university, this was with a lot of international students who were trying to make friends and trying to get into clubs and trying to meet people. And they end up having to stick to their own groups because people like, they're not assimilated enough. And when you were describing Greek life, I rushed early in my first year at university, and it's not the same culture of sororities and frats here. It's not as highly held up as like this thing that everybody must do and this like status symbol on college campuses. So
for sure.
I didn't end up trying for it for very long, but you could clearly see the people that end up making it anyway are always the people that just sort of fit that like very that very white centric sorority girl view. And I don't want to use the term sorority girl because that can be derogatory, but it's, I mean it as there is a certain type of person that fits in perfectly at a sorority or a frat house. And the people of color that are fitting in are very assimilated.
Yeah, 100%. And that is 100% on purpose, because just from being on the other side of Rush, a lot of the language that is used in selection is very coded. There's a mantra of like, choose sisters who are like your sisters. And if all of your sisters look one way, how are you ever going to get different sisters?
Yeah.
So it is on purpose. It is on purpose.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's, you know, when you think about complicity and erasure, it's a really, really tough, topic to begin to dissect, because at the end of the day, we all want opportunities. Who doesn't want to succeed? Who doesn't want, you know, academic opportunities? Who doesn't want economic opportunities? Mm-hmm. But when the opportunities themselves are so few for people of color, for BIPOC people, then of course, to a certain extent, we just end up being complicit in that kind, in, you know, perpetuating those kinds of harmful, toxic behaviors to other people around us, and mm-hmm. in the process, nothing changes. And so I think that, you know, you tackled it really well. And there was a line in the play that said, existing in the room doesn't change the walls. And that is something that really resonated with me, because I've spent my entire life looking around rooms where there is quote unquote diversity, and mm-hmm. everything feels very homogenous and white.
100%.
Yes. So I think that was them. That was a really interesting point. And then one of the things I thought a lot about was, you know, especially as a young person in college, there's so much pressure to fit in, to be popular, to make friends. And then you add all of this, you know, burden on people of color to also create equitable spaces. So how does our need to fit in override the importance of creating an equitable space?
Oh, well, there is, I think when the predominant space is white, the non-white, the POC and the crowd do all like just automatically stand out. And it is very, I think, at least with a lot of the predominantly white groups I've been on, there is this, culture of saying, more white people? No, we want diversity. But then the subculture is like, but we don't want too much.
Yeah.
And so that like breeds competition between POC for a very few number of spaces.
Yeah.
And so when that happens, I think that means, well, if I make it into a room, that's great. Then when I get into that room, I'll change it and I'll make sure more people of color can get in. But like, I want to be the one who gets in first.
Yeah.
I think that's something that, I'm trying to explore in this piece of what is our responsibility as women of color to other women of color in mm-hmm. our communities. Mm-hmm. And like what is our responsibility as community members to the community at large? I really wanted this play to instigate some change on my own college campus. I mean, there is a movement to abolish Greek life right now on Northwestern's campus. Some sororities and fraternities have canceled themselves. Like they're removing themselves. They're doing mass deactivations and opting out of it. But then there are also some chapters that have nationals headquarters that are sending adults to go run the recruitments themselves.
Because
people have invested so much money and time into Greek life as their identity for when they were in college that like the generations above with money just really don't want to see it end. But it's complicated.
No, it definitely is. And I've actually tried to contextualize a lot of these concepts in terms of the message of Lean In, which was, you know, 5, 7, 8 years ago, whenever it was written, it was like the book for feminism and diversity. And everybody was like, oh, Sheryl Sandberg. And I think what I've come to realize is that her brand of Lean In feminism was always about, well, you have to lean into the system that already exists. So how can you make yourself a part of the system and make it work for you, as opposed to how can I change the system? Because the system itself is toxic and it needs to be disrupted. So, you know, I hadn't given Greek life any thought until I read your play, because of course there's so many institutions that are rife with this, but I can imagine as a student in, you know, it's something that is, it's so coveted, and it's in all the media that talks about, like, movies, it, you know, of course you're going to rush a sorority, and there's a very, you know, it's got a very, frats are talked about, but sororities not as much. So that was a really interesting part of the play. So that kind of brings me to your other play, Gut Punch, which was actually really funny, because actually I thought about my own, it reminded me of some of my own experiences in college, theater specifically, not in theater, but like producing plays. Like, I was part of student government where we were producing plays, and we produced Into the Woods. And I remember we had four actors of color, really, really talented people. And Into the Woods is a musical, so you need a lot of singing and you know, amazingly talented people. And they all either had a minor role or they were the voice of something where they're almost behind the scenes. And all the leads went to white people. And then we produced Grease, and it was the same thing where all like Grease is the quintessential American, you know, musical. And it just all of the leads were white people. And so it was really interesting reading the play where there's this subtext almost of a person of color who's the only minority person on the, although there, I think, yeah, the, she's the only minority person on the, on, in her improv group. And she is the most talented character, person, actor, it seems. She's the most talented one. And she seems to be carrying a lot of her castmates. And it was really interesting how she kept getting sideswept every time she tried to monologue or participate. Is that something that, you know, you've seen or you felt in the theater community?
Oh, well, at least from like an improv community comedy perspective, I mean, I've been very, very lucky to be in a couple of different spaces with some very, very talented improvisers. But at least what some of my goal was for Gut Punch was showing the ways that we are like silencing the improvisers of color, especially when it comes to, there would be instances during a show sometimes where I was like, oh my gosh, we're getting so problematic so fast. I have to swipe it. It's my job to swipe it. I'm the only one seeing it. We have to end the scene and go to the next piece. Which is sad, because a part of the reason I was so interested in improv, was because you can kind of write your own characters as you think of them, and so you don't have to worry about like fitting the casting description for a script. You can just be a character, not for the sake of just like being South Asian. It's tough to improvise with people when you don't know what they're gonna say, if they have a history of saying problematic things. And that's ultimately why I left one of my improv groups, was just I got really sick of being worried all the time and being very anxious about what was going to be said on stage or in rehearsal. It's interesting that you say that you thought the one character of color in Gut Punch was the most talented one, because honestly, I think she's maybe written as the worst improviser, just because she keeps cutting people off. But I mean, there is the trade-off of, do you want to be a good improviser and like say some really funny stuff and like level it up? Or do you want to not hear something said that you know is going to be really problematic and then have to like participate in that scene? Like there's
because
a lot of long form improv is that you then call back to the scenes that were just said throughout the piece. And it's like,
right,
do you want that to be the through line? That's a tough one. So that like exploring that balance was something I was excited about in Gut Punch. Also, it is an exercise. Gut Punch was commissioned by Alter Theater. And so working with, it was like the first time I've ever been in an entirely POC cohort, cohort. So it was like five of us and we wrote these plays together. And it was the first time I felt so, coming off of like a year-long playwriting sequence where I was in a predominantly white room writing Radial Gradient at a white university. It was so exciting to be part of the room that Alter Theater created. And I mean, all the characters in Gut Punch are played by actors of color. Just three of them are performing whiteness. And I remember when we were casting and having auditions for it, some actors of color came in and they were just like, yeah, that's what it's like to be that. I mean, that's, playing whiteness is so funny. Like, why aren't we like commenting on the performance of whiteness?
Exactly. And I love how you wrote it in there. I love how you wrote it in there when you said that, you know, wear blonde wigs and drape yourself in like vines and, you know, colonize in your mind or whatever, go nuts, you know what to do. And I was like, yeah, we do know what to do. We automatically know what to do to perform whiteness.
Yeah. Because we're so good at, some of us are so good at assimilating.
Yeah.
Which is then an exploration of assimilating again. I'm just writing the same play again and again.
In some ways, yeah, because we have to keep exploring this topic. And I think there's so many layers to it. So, you know, you can go deeper and deeper on different trajectories to try and understand this. It's such a complex issue. And it's something that is so deeply entrenched in our society. It's been entrenched for 200 years. Like every single person on this planet has been born into a racist world. Mm-hmm. That is the world we live in. So, you know, back to your point where you said, I think on some level, it is everybody's job to at least start to weed it out in ourselves, whether it's our mm-hmm. own complicity, whether it's our own, self-directed racism. I mean, there's so much talk now about being colonized in your mind and what that means coming out of, you know, and generational colonization and generational racial trauma. There's just so much to explore with this topic. And I think that having conversations like this with people that are really in different spaces, like mm-hmm. your experience is so much about the theater community and the college community and what you've experienced there, the microaggressions, the harmful behavior. And that's a completely different perspective from honestly, I think the ones that get talked about more, which is like the corporate world, obviously, because mm-hmm. that's where like a lot of people spend a lot of their time and what we value, right? Like as a society, if we value capitalism, then that's where we're going to have those conversations. But it's in everything. It's in all spaces. So Jasmine, looking to the future, you are working with Chichi Anyanwu, and she is changing the game for BIPOC actors and POC actors and talent managers and just people in the acting space and the theater space, people of color. And, you know, what is your hope for how this changes in, you know, in the near future, especially in the theater world?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really love working with Chichi. It was the luckiest thing that came out of 2020 for me. There's so many things about working with Chichi I love. And one is that there's such an honest line of communication. Like, I never have to worry about being sent into an audition room that's going to make me uncomfortable or scared. And I know Chichi's in my corner if something ever happens. But I mean, I've been in auditions where they ask me to put on an accent, or they ask me to if I'm willing to change my like appearance in certain ways, and sometimes that means tanning or doing certain eyeliner. And there's a lot of problematic things about theater because it's such a visual art form that I hope are changing but are still there right now. But like from working with Chichi and from like going in on some of these auditions I've been going in and the work that's coming in now, I'm really excited about one, the kinds of stories we're going to be telling post-pandemic, two, we're going to be doing it. I think we're going to have to be doing it equitably, because something about being online for so long and being in Zoom is that we've met people from all over the country, the world, and a lot of these like online theater production rehearsal rooms and panels. And so we know what's possible. Like, we know we can figure out what everyone in the room is being paid. We know an Excel, I have an Excel chart of actors and writers and stage managers of color, so that when someone says, oh, I'm sorry, we have to put a white person in this role because we don't know any POC who would be good for it. Like, I have an Excel chart of people who would be. I mean, we're not going to be able to use the same excuses. I think people are only going to want to see theater if it's being done equitably, at least in the theater community too. I'm excited for actors of color to be more than their identity moving forward.
The kinds of, you know, stuff that you're writing about, the work that you're doing, and just like your passion for creating more equitable spaces in the space that you're in. Like, we just need more people that are passionate about it as well. And I think, people are, a lot of people are changing, they're and opening their mind to learn and to listen and learn, but also to, you know, kind of take action in the spaces that they're in. And I think, you know, I loved your plays, and I can't wait to see what you do as an actor, and I hope, and a writer, and I hope I will see you someday on stage, somewhere where I can sit in the audience and watch it with 400 other people.
Remember the days when.
But thank you so much, Jasmine, for talking to me today and sharing your story and sharing your experience and for creating such great art.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. If you want to catch up on all episodes of this podcast or get more great content, head on over to womeninourtown.com or follow the conversation on Instagram and Twitter at womeninourtown.